And now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. And, of course, to that foxy, fine-looking First Lady over in the corner. What's up, baby? Throughout my first weeks in office, I have been accused of not trying hard enough to cheer you up, of bringing too much gloom and doom, of being too honest with the American people. Now, as I speak to you every few hours about the state of our economy, I have tried to level with you about the gravity of our situation, which is, let me repeat, deeply, deeply screwed up. Way more than I even thought when I took this job. But tonight, let me offer these reassuring words that I know so many of you have been wanting to hear. America rocks. This is, like, the awesomest country ever. America has been, always will be. And if you don't like it, you can get the hell out. From the housewife in Pocatello, Idaho, who embodies American awesomeness every time she pulls her Chrysler minivan into the high school football game in time for the Pledge of Allegiance, to the one-armed Hispanic sewer maintenance worker in Coral Gables, Florida, who still manages to find time to pin a flag pin on his coveralls each morning at 3 a.m., to the 94-year-old widow on a fixed income living in an unheated shack deep in a coal mine in western Pennsylvania, caring for 16 foster children all while going to night school to obtain her law degree. This country will triumph, and we will keep our chins up. To assist in this historic effort, I have asked Joe Biden to lead an unprecedented National Party Planning Committee, because when it comes to planning a fiesta, no one messes with Joe. What do you think, Joe?
That sounds awesome!
Okay. In conclusion, I know times are bad, but don't get me wrong, America has never been awesomer. Good night for now, and please don't miss my next press conference coming up in about 15 minutes.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Republican response.
Well, hello. I did not see you there. I'm Bobby Jindal, governor of the great state of Louisiana. Happy Mardi Gras! Woohoo! Now, that was some nice speechifying right there, I tell you what. But as my daddy always used to say, Bobby, y'all don't trust no government. No way, no how. You just keep to your business, let other people keep to them's own business, and everything will be just fine. My parents were both immigrants to this country, and if there's one thing I've learned from my experience growing up in this country, it is this complex and deeply nuanced point. Americans can do anything. Americans can lift a car off a screaming child. Americans can crush a beer can against their forehead. Americans can divert a huge storm that threatens to destroy one of our major cities. Haha, well, maybe not that last one. But Americans can do almost anything. Democrats believe Americans are a bunch of helpless babies, unable to feed themselves or get a job. Republicans know better. Republicans know Americans can do anything. Just remember that, and we'll be fine. I guarantee it. I'm Bobby Jindal. And now, I'm going to keep on walking in the direction I was already walking in when I encountered this camera in my hallway.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Horwich, and welcome to the first podcast-only episode of In the Loop. In honor of our newfound freedom, I thought we'd do something totally crazy and put some funny stuff at the very top of the show. And I know what you're thinking. Jeff, that wasn't that funny. You're right, but that's not the point. The point is, that's the kind of thing we couldn't do on the radio because there's a protocol there. You know, you don't just launch into an Obama impression for 2 minutes because people would get confused. And not just because my impression is so 100% spot on perfect. No, the vast majority of people listening would be like, what the heck is this? What am I listening to? Is this Kai Rizdal? Well, in this world that we're playing in now, you know who we are. You're here because you are choosing to listen. And let me just say, thank goodness for you. In the Loop was on the radio long enough to develop a pretty decent base of listeners, and many of you had already gone digital because, honestly, if you don't live in Minnesota and commute at 6 o'clock on Friday, that was what you had to do if you wanted to hear the show. And for the 4 years that I've been working on some version of In the Loop, we have always tried to make it worth downloading. So in a way, this is not that big of a leap for us. But now that we are radio-free, we will be mixing things up quite a bit in the next few months, moving some stuff around, asking you to try some new things and give us advice on how we can shape the show. And we're going to be releasing a lot more of the things we do kind of as we go. For example, that Obama Jindal thing was up on our blog about 12 hours after the actual State of the Union that was not a State of the Union this week. Such is the speed and power of Ted Stevens' series of tubes, and we intend to take advantage of it. This operation is still really just Sandin and me, plus whatever great stuff we gather from you all, but we're going to try to keep things as fresh and active as two little people can. And as much freedom as we have to play around, we will always maintain our special combination of more serious and less serious approaches, global topics and more personal ones. That is our identity. That's what we do. In that spirit, let's get on to our next segment here. Enough navel gazing. Sandin was rather taken with a column the other day by a guy named George Friedman. He was offering some recommendations for America's shifting strategy and tactics in Afghanistan. And in the meantime, we had some new developments to contemplate. President Obama made his first big military decision on Afghanistan, even in the middle of all this economic turmoil. George Friedman is the CEO of Stratfor, which describes itself as a global intelligence company. They're based in Austin, Texas, but he's on a book tour right now, and we caught up with him in Washington, D.C. George, thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure to be here.
The president is sending 17,000 more troops now to Afghanistan, which should increase troop levels there by about 50%. Is there anything wrong with that as an opening move?
Well, the question is, what's the strategy? He initially intended to spend 30,000 troops. The decision to send 17,000 troops straddles the line between those who have argued there should be no increase and those who ask for a more robust increase. One of the rules of warfare is you either do something decisive or you don't do anything at all. And Obama surprised everyone by going right down the middle.
Does that just simply not inspire confidence in you that they've got a bigger strategy, a bigger philosophy for what they're doing here?
If we remember the surge that George Bush carried out, it came in the wake of the 2006 elections where he was devastated, the party was devastated. And the expectation by everyone, including the Iraqis, was that the United States really would start withdrawing. The decision to increase the number of troops in Iraq was really a psychological shock to Iraq. What Obama has done in Afghanistan does not create the same psychological shock.
It's just not enough? Is that the basic point here?
Well, the point that Bush did was essentially tell the Iraqis he's crazy. He's not going to stop. And that created a situation in which the Sunni insurgents, our worst enemies there, were prepared to negotiate. What Obama has signaled is that he's going to be very cautious about this. And from the Taliban's point of view, that's excellent because they have succeeded extremely well in an environment where the United States and its NATO allies have been extremely cautious. And if the policy of extreme caution continues, they don't have to negotiate.
Now, it's a little interesting to hear you say this because based on some of your thoughts that I've read here, you've argued that throwing troops at Afghanistan is not what we need to do here.
Having 30,000 or 60,000 or 100,000 troops operating in Afghanistan is not going to be very effective in hunting down cells of 20 or 30 al-Qaeda operatives. So to me, the issue of hunting down al-Qaeda operatives really is an intelligence issue that depends on covert operations, detecting where the enemy is, and special forces and airstrikes to destroy the enemy. In other words, focusing on the threat of terrorism rather than on the broader picture.
And you're saying we don't even worry about necessarily working with the government there. We find out where the problems are. We call in strikes right away and just get the job done in a very practical sense.
Well, the way I would put it is there is no government there. There's a man we call the president. And what we have to do is stop fantasizing that we have an effective government in Afghanistan and face the reality as it is. And this is very uncomfortable for President Obama, who is uncomfortable with covert operations, clearly uncomfortable with what he sees as the excesses of the CIA. But what I'm arguing is the strategy he's pursuing is wrong, and he really has to focus in on his primary mission, and that has got to be a covert operation.
Why are you so ready to write off the government in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai in particular?
Hamid Karzai only appears to be the government of Afghanistan. He is something propped up by the Americans. He has no legitimacy in most of the countryside. And so trying to build on the Karzai government is building on a base of sand.
Don't you put any stock in the fact that Afghanis, maybe even the Taliban, would look at President Obama as a different sort of person? They might view America differently now. This whole notion that, you know, our guy at the top looks different, talks differently. Maybe they're people around the world would deal with this differently.
I'm not sure that's positive. I mean, look, whatever we think of George Bush, what he did in Iraq after catastrophic miscalculations worked. In a sense, the Petraeus-Bush team is the gold standard of counterinsurgency. Obama is coming in, and they're looking at him, can he live up to what Bush and Petraeus did in Iraq? The idea that he's coming in and he's going to be a more reasonable person and therefore more amenable to negotiation is really not what the Taliban is going to respond to.
George, paint me a picture quickly, if you would. What is the best that we can hope for at this point in Afghanistan?
The very best we can hope for, I think, is a government that is Islamist, but finds it not useful to provide sanctuary for terrorists. But we need, I think, to move from the idea that we will build a strong Afghan government and deny terrorists a base to the idea that we will have to deny terrorists a base even without a strong Afghan government.
George, thanks very much for your time today. It's been good to talk with you.
It's good talking to you.
George Friedman is the CEO of Stratfor, online at stratfor.com. He's currently on the road promoting his new book, New York Times bestseller, which I very much intend to read. I do. The Next 100 Years. You are listening, of course, to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. And I want to take just a moment here to mention something that we can really use, especially now that we are entirely digital. We need reviews of In the Loop, and we need them on our Facebook page, and we need them especially on iTunes. Now, there's an app I added to our Facebook page a little while back for reviews. It's kind of low down on the page, but it remains empty. We'd love to get something in there. And on iTunes, we've got some great reviews, but they're pretty old, and I'd love to freshen those up. Being all digital, it is so vital now that we let people know who we are and send any signals we can about why they might want to check us out. If you like the show and you have literally like a spare minute or two, just throw a review up there and let other folks know what you think. And I personally would be deeply, deeply grateful as we try and figure this thing out and sketch out our survival moving ahead. Now we're going to have a go at our semi-regular feature where we check in with one of our listeners out there who follows a particular area of the news especially closely. And today it is Farron Williams, who lives in Bealeton, Virginia. Farron, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
By profession, you're a software engineer, right?
That's correct.
What kind of software do you work on?
Mostly sonar sub-combat systems.
Sonar sub-combat systems? Wow. That's really cool. I was thinking you'd say, like, spreadsheets, Quicken, or, you know.
No, this is real national defense stuff. So.
Ah, nifty. But today we're going to talk about your other passion, which is personal finance. Why is that such an obsession for you?
The world of personal finance is just amazing. So many things going on, news all over the world, 24-hour trading. There's never a dull moment, as you can tell.
Well, if you like to follow that stuff, I guess maybe you can get some amount of cheer out of what's going on.
Kind of hard to be happy about it, but it's interesting.
First up, let's talk about 401ks, retirement plans run through your employer, just for people who aren't totally familiar with the term. How's your 401k doing, Farron?
My 401k balance from last year is down probably about 40%, like a lot of people.
Sounds common, yeah.
It was a tough year, but if you think about it, there have been previous years like this. The big thing is consistency. When you're young, you keep putting in money. And just think of it as you're buying stocks on sale. When the stock market recovers, you should see a nice little bounce in your balance.
You pointed out to us that in the midst of this downturn, some companies are actually adding 401ks for their employees. What's going on there?
A lot of smaller companies right now who didn't have 401ks are actually starting to pick up 401ks. Offering a 401k gives them an entree into snaring some talent that's out there. Right now, there's been a lot of downsizing. A lot of companies have laid off people. And a lot of the smaller companies see this as a way to pick up, you know, talented mortgage brokers, finance people, and build up their employee pool at a time when larger companies have to cut theirs.
Adding just the 401k doesn't cost very much. Now, many companies offer a match. You know, you put in some money and then the company puts in some money too. On that front, companies that have 401ks and 401k matches, well, some of them are cutting back, right?
FedEx, Eastman Kodak, Motorola have all, you know, started suspending their matches for 401ks. Actually, my employer scaled back on their match for this year.
Just how much did they pull back on you?
About 2% on the match, 6% to a 4%. So it wasn't a total loss, but it's going to hurt.
That does hurt.
And it's not even just the match. If you think about it, you know, at this time you're buying stocks cheaply, so that's 2% would be buying more stocks. When the stock market recovers and they put the match back in place, you know, you've lost all this money that you could have been making.
If companies are cutting back on their 401k match, what do you think? Are there better places to invest? Should we not be putting so much in our 401ks? Not that we should say the usual asterisk here. You are not an investment advisor.
Yes.
But what do you think?
You know, a wise rule of investing is you invest in your 401k up to the match. After that, you put money into a Roth IRA, which allows you to put aside money after tax, but you can withdraw at retirement tax-free.
Uh-huh.
So you can build up a tax-free bundle of money that you can use after retirement. If you don't get a match at all, it may be wise to start off with the Roth, invest the maximum in that, and then move on to investing in your 401k.
Here's another trend that you brought to our attention, the disappearing dividend. And let's just define a basic personal finance term for people who might not know. What is a dividend?
Okay, a dividend is a payment that's made by a corporation to its shareholders. Essentially, you buy the stock, and every quarter, they'll send out a portion of their profit.
So it gets back to what owning a stock technically is, which is owning a piece of the company, and they make some money, and they give you your share of that money.
Yeah, and a lot of people used to see these as widows and orphan stocks, basically. Mm. You know, stocks that you would buy for someone who's looking for current income, retirees, anyone who needed to live off their investment.
So where's the dividend going?
The dividend is disappearing because profitability is disappearing. You know, a lot of these companies aren't making profits. Some of the banks are having problems with their balance sheets. They're also under pressure from Congress and lawmakers who gave them bailout cash. So they're being pushed into not providing a dividend.
You think this will turn into a sort of a long-term trend, though? Even when things turn around, is the dividend going to come back, too?
For some of these companies, the dividend will come back, but it's going to take time for it to build up. Companies that pay dividends, that's factored into their value. So you bought the stock and you're expecting a certain dividend or a level of increasing dividend. What happens is when they cut the dividend, all of a sudden their stock becomes a lot less valuable because it was already a slower growing stock and the people who owned it bought it for the dividend. So like if you look at something like Bank of America, you know, one of the reasons why their slide has been so pronounced is that as they've cut their dividend, people have sold it, and if they sold it, it's dropped the price down, they cut their dividend more, and then it just, you know, it becomes a downward spiral.
Right. Well, and without dividends, you know, this other logic of the stock market, which is that you buy stuff, the value of it goes up, and you sell it, you make money. Well, that doesn't quite hold up so well now either. So how are you supposed to make money in the markets these days?
Right now, making money in the markets is pretty hard. I mean, you really have to sort of hold on for dear life and, you know, stick with a consistent plan. This is the time when you really want to focus on what you're doing, because if you get off track, you can make a big mistake and really ruin your future. You know, it could look ugly.
Farron, it's been really good to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That is Farron Williams, submarine combat software engineer by day, personal finance aficionado, also by day, I guess. Just want to reinforce this so we don't get into any trouble here. Neither Farron Williams nor Jeff Horwich are certified investment advisors. They're just two guys who talked about it for 5 minutes. Do your own research before making investment decisions. This message brought to you by the Association of Public Radio Legal Counsels. Okay, so it's been a couple of weeks since we had a new podcast or brought any new material to you. I apologize for that. We've been kind of figuring things out, just getting our bearings. And I'll admit to kind of a bout of musical writer's block during that time. But this week I decided to ease myself back into it with something fairly simple. Old school country is pretty easy to approach. I was thinking about how active the new president and Congress have been the last couple of weeks. Every single day it seems like there's a new plan, more billions of dollars devoted to getting the economy to turn around. But the stock market just sinks deeper. The gloomy feeling goes on. Nobody seems to be taking any solace from any of this. And as in so many things, I guess, I think we want to feel better. But it is evidently going to take some time.
You'd think with all the things that you've been trying, perhaps I'd start to see the sun somehow. You'd think that I'd be past the time for crying, and I should be feeling better by now. You'd think that now we're spending all this money, taking stock and making rules for what we will and won't allow. But trying to smile still makes me feel all funny. I should be feeling better by now. It seems we're having heart-to-hearts almost every single day. You're level with me just the way you should. Each day it seems you're doing more, not sure what I'm waiting for. Somehow nothing helps me to feel good. You'd think with all you're trying to do to cheer me, maybe you'd get through to me somehow. You'd think that things might stop feeling so dreary, and I should be feeling better by now. Yes, I should be feeling better by now.
All right, country, good genre to choose for getting back on the horse. In the Loop is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We get editing assistance from Kate Smith. You can find us online at minnesotapublicradio.org or check this out, looptastic.net. Just acquired that one just for fun. And if it sticks in your brain, that's one way you can find us. If you like this jazzy, funky kind of music that we use under segments like this, well, that stuff's by my buddies, The Smarts, and you can find them online at thesmartsband.com. Keep an ear to what we're doing. Keep an eye on the website, and we'll have more call-outs for content. We're going to definitely want your ideas and reflections about how we can evolve in our new digital ness. So stick with us. I don't know exactly when our next podcast will come out. Our deadlines are a little more flexible now, but we are back at it, and I hope you enjoy what we have for you. I'm Jeff Horwich. Thank you for listening.